welcome to the Regenerative Rising podcast, Elevating Voices, Activating Change. I'm your guest host, Angela McGowey, and today I am thrilled to be joined by Anne Armbrecht, author, and just an esteemed anthropologist who has done a beautiful job of illuminating work between people and supply chains and planet and creating a link there. She has a very lengthy bio, which I won't attempt to do full justice to here, but she's a writer and anthropologist, and her work explores the relationship between humans and the earth. She's the author of the award-winning ethnographic memoir, Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home, which explores the connections between culture, community, and place, both in Eastern Nepal and the US. She's the director of the Sustainable Herbs Program, an extension of the American Botanical Council, which educates and inspires action around ethical sourcing in the botanical industry. Anne, I'm thrilled to be with you today. Thank you for joining us.
I'm so thrilled to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you've authored a number of books, and the most recent one, The Business of Botanicals, you and I have had the opportunity to talk about before, and explores the supply chain within the herbal supplement and dietary supplement world. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that, but backing out a little bit and looking at a more broad scope, I'd love for you to share a little bit about how your work as an anthropologist has influenced the way that you've begun to examine commodities and supply chains, specifically the relationships globally, and how you've brought that perspective into your work.
Yeah, thanks for starting with that question. Just today, when I was thinking about the book again, which I haven't in this way for a little bit of time, and that I saw more clearly the anthropology, that it's really, the book is like a case study looking at what culture, where culture shows up and whether it can make a difference in global, in capitalism most broadly. I mean, it's about the botanical industry, but not really. It's about, what does ethical capitalism really look like? What does conscious capitalism actually mean? And that's what that word conscious, what is, you know, people talk about it all the time, and green capital, well, you know, everybody's using those words, but what's that mean? And so I think in the work I've been doing, it's really exploring that in different ways. And it comes down to people and connection between people and people and people, people and plants, people and planet, and what shapes those connections, and whether those connections can be sustained in these sourcing worlds that are, you know, global and invisible for most of, for what most of us see.
Yeah, absolutely. Those connections. I think as consumers, especially in the US, so many of us are so removed from our food. And then if you look at the supply chain and the herbal business, we're probably even more removed from that. As you began to understand more deeply what those supply chains look like within commodities, I know you spent a lot of time in India. What surprised you? What did you learn that like really surprised you?
Well, on a most immediate level, what surprised me was that it really matters, it really, really, really matters where your herbs come from, because the things that are bad are really bad. You really don't, you know, there's nothing around that's medicinal around some of the plants that are sourced anonymously in the, and bought in the open market. And that there's a huge difference in attention and quality between that kind that's just bought and sold on the global market and those that where companies are really trying to source responsibly. I think that was a surprise. And there, you know, I talk about that in the book and in on the Sustainable Herbs Program website, you know, which was a choice, like how much of the negative side story to tell. And I tell some of that because it's important to know why it costs more to buy from a company that is taking the time to invest. So that surprised me. I think another surprise, and this was more a personal one, you know, I thought I was really following plants through the supply, you know, back to the source. But really what stayed with me, what emerged as the most meaningful for me was really the people. And even today, when I was looking back through the book again at the parts where I'm visiting producer groups, you know, and even in my work now, when I talk with people in producer groups, the care and attention and the connection and the openness, I love it. You know, that's the part that has so much meaning for me, which again makes me think back again to that bigger question about, can connection be found in like an economic system that depends on disconnecting objects from the source? You know, I talk about the section in Nature's Metropolis, which is historian William Cronin's book, where he's talking about that unraveling of wheat from the fields in Chicago. And he's, you know, once wheat became a commodity, it became no longer connected to that farmer field. That is kind of what I see as the root of a lot of the problems now. You know, Wendell Berry talks about how by not seeing those fields or forests, we can ignore the moral and ecological consequences of purchasing those commodities. And so I wandered off from your question.
No, I think, yeah. I think the thread that's, thank you for sharing. I think there's a couple threads there to follow. And one is the people and the human connection. And, you know, when we are having rice here at the house and I make it for the kids, like a farmer grew that. So that came from somewhere, like someone's family depends on the livelihood that they make, you know, from the earth. And we're the beneficiaries of that, even if they're half a world away. So we really, we lose that in the commoditization of specific crops, especially, I think, especially food. But sticking with that human element, you know, is there, especially in your travels outside of the US, is there a moment that comes to mind when you think about, wow, that was really a moment for me that touched me deeply and it influenced you? And as an anthropologist, in a way that you brought to your work, helping to illuminate this global web we have?
Well, there's so many. And I think so I was so timid when I started this project to contact people, to ask if I could come visit. And the first trip I made was to Eastern Europe to visit Fair Wild certified projects, in part because they were open to having a Westerner, an outsider come, because they need that story told so more people will buy that product. Whereas other companies weren't so interested in having someone coming to research and write about what they're doing. And what immediately struck me there was, not everyone, but in some places, like especially in Eastern Poland, how immediately open to a connection most everyone I met was. And I think that had to do with the topic, which was about the plants. And also I think, and this touches on like a bigger question that I explore in the book, my quality of attention and presence. I didn't come with an agenda, and I was curious and I asked questions. And I think people responded to that. And I got more confident in that as I went on. And so again, it didn't always happen and there were a lot of challenges, but when that connection did happen, you know, I'm thinking again in Kodai Canal in southern India, just this person who I happened upon his house and we had tea and then went for several walks. And he shared his story about living in the jungle for 15 years. And it was just a little encounter. But that ability to connect across such difference. I also want to say it was really challenging because to follow commodities, which is like, you know, this anthropology professor of mine years ago said three ways to do research. One is following commodities, and that kind of caught my curiosity. But doing that, so sort of multi-sited ethnographic research, is really, really hard because I am trained to spend like a year and a half in a village of 500 households and really do deep knowledge. And so this was a lot of different places. And so how to find the thread that had meaning was challenging.
Wow. That's incredible. The idea of that type of deep work and what you learn. I mean, you did that deep, you know, site work, early in your career, it sounds like in Nepal and India. Was that also commodity based following?
No, the research in Nepal was looking at villagers' connection with the land and farming practices and the village healers, their connection with the landscape and land tenure, private property, common property, which actually really so gets back to the first question you asked around that. It was really about the cultural framework. They weren't just interacting with the earth as, okay, here's rice to sell in the market. There was a set of practices that guided that relationship and structured it. You know, they would make offerings to the new rice in order to ensure a good harvest. And they would make offerings to ensure that the rains came on time. It was a give and take reciprocal relationship. And then when I came back to the US after that, that's when I started studying herbal medicine with Rosemary. And I found something similar in that framework, that plants weren't just something to take as much as I wanted so I would be well. It was really, I made an offering, there was an exchange, there was a give and take. It was the sense of that context, of being in the context, that shaped the interaction, as well as the fact that, you know, the plants are alive. And so what does that aliveness mean? It's, we're not in control. It's a relationship.
So. Yes, that reciprocal nature is, I think, really powerful. And it's something in Western agriculture, at least sort of at scale, that you don't find, unless it's actually in Native people communities. I mean, I think, you know, that sort of connection to the land is still very much a part of that Native community within the U.S. and First People communities. Were you able to, you know, spending that time in Nepal and connecting to the way they tend the land and the differences there, and then seeing how there's similarities in the study of herbalism, where there's this respect between people and plants and coevolution and reciprocity, would you say that there were lessons that you thought, wow, I wish this in the Western world would sort of be more commonly adopted? Like, what would that be? What were those key takeaways from your perspective?
Yeah, I thought, oh, this is the answer. I mean, I kind of do this. Like, I think this is the answer to everything and everybody needs to know about it. And so with herbal medicine, I was that way. I mean, you know, and going to Nepal, when I went to Nepal, I had a lot of ideas, romantic ideas about indigenous peoples as having the answer. And, you know, of course, nothing so simple. And it was much more complicated. And they couldn't figure out why in the world I would want to come spend a year and a half of my life in this village where most people my age and younger, I was in my 20s and early 30s, just wanted to leave. You know, so it's not all perfect. You know, there's a lot of complexity and nuance. And similar with herbal medicine, you know, I started studying and I thought, oh, this is the answer to everything. Not herbal products, herbal medicine, like growing your own, learn how empowering it felt to really know what was growing outside my door, how I could make remedies that I could use for my kids and myself to be well. And then as I learned more about the industry, I thought, oh, not everybody knows these amazing values of herbal medicine. And so my husband's a filmmaker, so we made a movie, Newman, which means the animating force in all things living, that sort of invisible numinousness of the plant world. So we made this documentary to spread the wisdom, I thought. And I was struck there by how it was received. People who knew about herbal medicine loved it, embraced it, thought, yes. But those who didn't were like, what? I don't get it. What's this about? And that line was drawn in an interesting way too. People who bought food from the farmer's market, who would only feed their kids organic vegetables, they it didn't think twice about going to a pharmacy and using Tylenol or Advil or over-the-counter cough syrup. And so I was struck by that, like, how did medicine become something different?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I just was observing that what you talked about being most touched by when you talk about herbalism was the empowerment. Like, you know, it was the connection between the plants and people, but it was also the self-empowerment of, I grew this and then I took it and I used the right part to make something that probably humans and people and, like, you know, indigenous cultures have used some variety of this for many, many, you know, decades, hundreds of years. But herbal business has evolved in a way that what you talk about is now such a small portion. I mean, the natural products industry is very large. The herbal supplement industry is, I think it was in 2020, $11.2 billion. It grew at 17% year over year. So obviously, you know, this is a very different scenario than somebody who has a kitchen garden and is harvesting their lemon balm and, you know, making infused honey and teas. And, but that empowerment that you felt and that you witnessed in other cultures is something that is very powerful. And, maybe, you know, it goes back to victory gardens, right? Like, how do we as a culture in the U.S., how do we regain some of that from your anthropological perspective?
And, I was, again, when I was looking back at the book and that the part when I was trying to follow herbs through the supply chain, and I realized everything I was learning about doing this was disempowering. You know, everything about the botanical, a lot of the industry is, it's buy this product, and it can be very hard to get behind the veil. And Dr. Ram Kumar, an Ayurvedic practitioner in Southern India, who was creating this healing center, and what he sees as the greatest threat to Ayurvedic medicine is the cultural framework, not the plants. Although the plants are quite threatened in India, he said, that there are no longer doctors who understand really how to work with the plants, the depth of the complexity of the plants, and they just prescribe things like allopathic medicine in that sort of this for that, which can be like this for that herbal medicine. And so he's first focusing on bringing the making of the medicine into how a practitioner is working with their clients. And then he said, once he kind of helps strengthen that, then they can start paying attention to the plants. I mean, this is his theory. You know, I think actually you also really have to pay attention to the plants in India because they're quite threatened. But that the idea of a cultural framework that is going to shape and be empowering for both the practitioner, right? Because then you're not just a pharmacist handing something out, as well as the client, because they have it. They see, in his case, they would see the kashayams percolating in the practitioner's office. So that's one way, right? And that's relearning herbal medicine in the US and things like that. But I also think, for me, it was incredibly empowering to find the stories of the people and places behind these products. And it was fascinating and gave so much more meaning to any of these products. I mean, I don't really use many herbal products, actually, except ones I kind of make my own myself. But I love the people and I love the journey and I love understanding the challenges. And so I wonder if all of us, right, shifted from being just a consumer looking at a shelf overwhelmed, like, which one do I buy? Which brand of echinacea or elderberry? You know, the choices are endless. But if we really used fewer products, but spent time contacting the company, learning the stories, letting them know we want to know where things come from in a real way, not in a marketing way. Mm-hmm. How can we help? How can we get involved so that it's, you know, it goes back to early in the book when I'm talking about the difference between the process of making medicine versus just a product. So can it become something that's more of a process rather than just that stuck there trying to make decisions?
Yeah, I mean, that's a different type of relationship between the person who consumes products and the maker. And it's one that has to be led with curiosity. I think both on both sides, actually, curiosity on the side of the person who's purchasing a product and curiosity on the side of those who are making a product, being willing to be open to questioning rather than sort of a closed door approach. I'm curious, do you see that within the US as a consumer? Do you see that in particular parts of the supply chain? So not just in herbal medicine, but in food, are there parts of it where you think, oh, people are curious? Like, where do you observe that as being most prevalent, or is it at all?
Right. That's a good question. I'm trying to think in my own life how I do that, because we're all stretched thin and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering if there's a model, like, is there a model where there's already an accepted way of consumerism, even if it's small, that is much more conscious than sort of the conspicuous consumption that all of us are guilty of at some point, and we want to be more conscious about, like, what would it look like to start?
I mean, I think, you know, places like farmers markets are seeds for that, or, you know, so I think there are a lot of examples that aren't immediately coming to mind, but one idea that I was quite moved by that I haven't seen so much in the US, but I wonder if there's possibility here in Eastern Poland. I don't write about this in the book because it's a different model, but there was a man who had been a wild collector, and he then developed a manufacturing center for products, teas that were primarily sold in the Polish market. So they didn't have the challenges of international regulatory stuff, which can be a huge stumbling block. So that was the main source of income. Then he had built a large hotel, but it was all from old Polish houses that were being torn down, and he got them moved onto his land. And it was filled with young Polish families that were coming to stay there when we were the only outside Westerners there, or, you know, non-Polish speaking people there. And then they had a huge botanical garden and then an educational center. And so it was amazing. And there was so much vitality and vibrancy. And people were there coming to, you know, they would buy the teas and things like that. But there were these connections. And then there was another one in Hungary on Lake Balaton that was just starting, much smaller scale, similar manufacturing, education, and kind of a garden growing experience. And then Vajragama, where we were in South India, different model, but similarly trying to make these connections. And so maybe I feel like there's a lot of potential in the herb world around herb schools and herb farms, and that making some of those connections beyond that in the food world. There are like, I think of like Soulfire Farm, you know, these farms that are vibrant. Mm-hmm. They're about growing food, but they're about building connection and community and things. I think as we experience how much more meaning we get from that kind of, you know, you get your vegetables, but you get a larger something. Ezra Klein was saying in a podcast the other day, you know, that individual change, it kind of magnifies our values. That's a way of making change. So,
yeah. Yeah. The word you used, community, that to me is what that feels like, the thread there that ties that all together, because, you know, you're not just getting a weekly share of vegetables or, you know, a salve that, you know, someone in the community made. You're getting community, you're being nourished by that. And, you know, for as much as we've gained as, you know, in Western civilization, as humans, like through the digital age that we're in, we also have lost a lot of that in-person definition of community. And I think that's something in other parts of the world that especially that you've spent a lot of time in, that leads to, I think, that community leads to a different way of living, of eating, of, you know, there's sort of an intentionality, maybe. And that's sort of what I heard you sharing.
And it's interesting, you know, it's like part of it, you know, I think back to Hirangna where I was in Nepal, and that community can get really small. And somebody gets ahead and everybody else wants some of that pie, you know, so it's not all good, but what we have now isn't all good either. It feels like we've traded something for our not having people rely on us in that way, that we've lost something that seems really important that maybe we didn't want to lose, you know, about that connection that we get from being in a community. Having people depend on us means we have people we can depend on. And
the farmer's market is a great point. I mean, that's a place where community happens. It's a place where you can connect with the person. I mean, you know, you pick something up and the farmer is often standing right there in front of you. And, you know, that's, I think I've seen that also in other areas, like whether it's, you know, people selling beeswax candles at the farmer's market, or who raise, you know, shares of, you know, in animal agriculture, that is present as well. And I think that's a thread we can follow as a culture. You know, we're not a society of anthropologists. I think we're more sociologists than anthropologists, closet sociologists, maybe social media sociologists. But what do you think, how do people, especially US dwelling people, cultivate more of that awareness about what it means to be a conscious consumer of products?
Yeah, I think back to what you were saying about curiosity, which takes time, right? And we all think we don't have time. You know, it's interesting, you mentioned social media, which can be kind of a wall against curiosity, right? There's, in my experience in the herb community, because people are trying to make a living and they're trying to get students or they're trying to get people to look at their products, there's this pressure and urgency that it's not like the exhale that allows you to really have an exchange. And maybe it happens in some places in my experience. Yeah, that can be challenging.
What do you think people could do to, in the US, be more aware of even their disconnectedness, I guess, is another way to say it. You know, I think before, you know, before you solve a problem, you first have to understand the problem. And I think culturally in the US, unfortunately, like, you know, you're very aware through your career that we're disconnected from our food and we're disconnected from our medicine. And many Americans are not. This is just the way that we live. I mean, actually, I remember going to college in Ohio and I met my roommate. I was assigned a roommate, like, you know, you are or you were as a freshman. And I told her I was a vegetarian and she said, oh, so you don't eat potatoes? And it was like the most strange interaction. It was actually kind of hysterical, but for me, I was like, wow, people are really disconnected from what food even is. So going back to the question, like, where do you start in our culture with helping people even reach a place where there's some recognition of, right, this is grown in the ground. And if we don't do things to take care of our planet, then we may not have soil to grow things in the ground. And so this is all sort of reciprocal. It's not just about, you know, what we eat. It's about like our ability to thrive on this planet that we're so fortunate to have.
It's overwhelming, right?
It is.
You know, and as you were talking, what I thought of, well, I thought of two things. One, the work of that's a theory you coming out of MIT with this man, Otto Sharma, was talking, I was listening again to one of his videos, and it's sort of system awareness-based systems change, but he's saying we are collectively creating consequences that none of us want, you know, huge inequities, climate crisis, impact on soil. And so the work they're doing there is all about what do we need to do to turn this around and create things that we all want. I mean, everybody wants, not what we're creating. And the three things he's talking about, curiosity is the first, and an open heart, you know, sort of empathy, which, you know, especially maybe in the beginnings of the COVID pandemic, when we were all in this heightened fear of what's happening, it felt like there was this openness and quality of connection that maybe feels more hardened now into these groups of who's causing it and making it worse. And
yeah.
And so that open, that empathy, and, you know, some of the key things that people said, like Randy Burrish from Oregon's Wild Harvest, you know, talked about, it's all about love, you know, that loving the plants and wanting to grow seeds for him in the US, or Sebastian Pohl saying it's all about love. If you love people and plants, you want to take care of them.
So funny, Anne, that you just quoted that. I have your book here. And as I was rereading passages yesterday, I underlined, I'm not kidding, like I underlined, it's all about love. What do you love, and who do you love, and how do you want to love them? And if you love nature and you love people, you want to take care of them. And I was struck by, you know, you talked about capitalism, like, yes, you know, you're producing something, you're selling it. But if that is your why, if that's why, that's a very different energy that you're putting out into the world, even if it manifests itself as a product. So I'm glad you brought that up. And that's, I think that's really critical. It's also maybe kind of hard to unpack for a lot of people. Like, what does this have to do with anything?
Well, before, when the question made me think, and this again, that quotation that was at the beginning of the book, the Indian anthropologist who I met in his kitchen, and it was something about the heartbreak of losing taste, which makes me think about, so taste, like we all know, I mean, it's interesting, COVID brought a lack of taste, right? We all know it's an immediate direct sensation. We like this, we don't like it. It's a simple thing. You don't have to know where your food comes, you know, you don't have to get into the big abstractness of it, but beginning to awaken in that way, right, is that the seed of care, like we know what we care for, and it starts really small with each of us. Like we were just in Costa Rica this summer visiting regenerative farms to do some videos documenting the practices that they're doing for botanicals for the global market, and this one woman, Gary Brown, at Cinco Ramos Farm, said, you know, we can't do it all. We are doing what we can do. And what is needed is a whole bunch more people doing what they can do. Like, they're really caring for the soil and their little piece. And it needs each of us doing whatever we do that's expressed in a different way because of who we are. I don't know if that's clear, but that's, I think, that what I learned from this writing this book, you know, I thought I was going to learn about the supply chain and herbal medicine, but it's gets back to that point about what's empowering. Let me start again. I'll leave that.
Yeah, what you were just starting to share gets to a question I wanted to ask, actually. How did the process of writing and researching the business of botanicals change you? What did you learn that really changed the way you see life?
So I think before, and I was looking for answers outside of myself and for experts outside of myself, someone who was going to be able to like tell me how many herbs were actually sourced, but nobody can, or how many organic herbs are there, and nobody knows, how many fair trade, nobody knows. And what's exactly the right thing to do. And I was always told, well, it depends. Or where's the right company I should visit? And, you know, each place there were different things to learn that fed into what that I realized was really, this was my questions that I was asking. And that's like the work I'm here to do. And the work I'm here to do is different than the work you're here to do or anybody else. And this is kind of what I think Gary Brown was saying, their relationship with that piece of land, because they love it and they love gardening. And so, and they love their soil and they're caring for it. For me, because I'm an anthropologist, you know, because so I'm attuned, because I went into anthropology, because I'm maybe particularly attuned to relationships with people and culture and values. That's where plants led me on this journey. So that they were leading me on this journey that helped me gain the confidence in my vision and my work, that this is the piece I'm here to hold and do, which isn't the piece anyone else is here to do. You know, I kept thinking it was someone else who was going to come do it for me. So I don't know if that was clear, but it's that the medicine's not the healing thing. It's the journey.
Yeah.
And it's part of that. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's also part of like the high quality herbal product is going to be more nourishing and supportive and all of that, but it's not only that.
Well, yeah, your journey of, I mean, which has been so extensive and, you know, has encompassed not just the research for the book, but really your whole career of understanding dynamic relationships between land and people and, you know, plants and, you know, this web of life is different than someone else's. But I think the learning there that you identified is true for all of us. The journey is the teacher. If we're tuned in to those learnings, it actually reminds me, you're a bibliophile and a lover of words as a writer and like me, but there's a beautiful Emily Bronte quote from Wuthering Heights that I love. She writes, "I've dreamt in my life dreams that have stayed with me ever after and changed my ideas. They've gone through and through me like wine through water and altered the color of my mind." And I have that up on my wall and I love it because it just reminds me, like, in order to change a system or change a mind, you have to be open to that. You know, you can't, it has to go through you. So I think that the work that you're doing and illuminating supply chains and challenges, is just so rich and so precious. What do you see as next as you continue to learn?
Wait, I wanted to just follow up on your Bronte quotation, because the book I wrote before, Thin Places, I started it with a quotation from Rilke that there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life.
Oh, yeah.
Same idea. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. What next? Well, now I'm, you know, sort of full-time doing the Sustainable Herbs Program, and lately have really been focused on working with companies who are committed to best practices as best they can or on that journey and really working to build more of a collaborative network among companies to share ideas to help better address and tackle some of the problems that are cross-cutting and that are kind of unique to the botanical people, companies sourcing botanicals, which is different than foods or, you know, or cacao or coffee or single commodities. And so, you know, it's all the issues you're well familiar with Gaia, but there, it seems that there's a lot of collaboration in sort of other sectors around food and regenerative farming practices in the food or the cattle and things like that. And this is really trying to help sort of nourish that in the botanical industry. So that's one thing, and creating resources and best practices for implementing like toolkits and things like that. And then the series of videos that I'm really excited about from our trip to Costa Rica. We visited like 5 different farms, all totally committed to the soil using. Some were called themselves regenerative, some were syntropic, for, you know, different names, analog forestry, things like that, but all really working with the plants and the soil and with different ownership models, and which was interesting, you know, some owned by themselves, hiring workers, some you know, owned by a US company or a partnership. And so we'll do a series of videos to highlight the one, really the soil practices and how they're caring for the plants, and quite complex and specific practices. And then the other, looking at the equity and farmer relationships and how to sort of support farmers, people doing the work in a better way, so there's more opportunity for dignified livelihood.
That's great. Do you find in your travels, and I mean, most recently in Costa Rica, but also, you know, in India, and is there a greater awareness about the importance of soil health as just a foundation of sort of the underpinning of our food system? Is there more awareness of that in these places than there is in the US, or what's your perspective on that?
Like, I'm not really qualified to judge. I think it's so much like who you, you know, and in Costa Rica, we were going to farms. We weren't walking down San Jose asking, oh, what do you care about the soil? So, you know, we were had specifically chosen communities that were really devoted to this. And yet Costa Rica is really committed to, like, as the national government, even though they've been known as producing more, using more agrochemicals, I think, than, I couldn't find the exact statistic, either Central America or the whole world, or some kind of really startling statistic. But there is now a movement really to better care for the soil. And so when I was looking for farms to visit, there's tons, tons, much more than the US. So India, and India also, you know, my time in India, we have a lot of farms that weren't committed to those. I've been told, you know, if I'd gone, there are pockets, and there's certainly other people who really are, you know, India, it can be really hard to find that. So I think it's complicated.
Yeah. You mentioned the farmer that you visited in Costa Rica said, you know, I'm just doing what I can do and other people need to do what they can do. And, you know, that can show up for each of us in very different ways. But, with your studies in herbalism and your connection to land and, you know, the way that you live, if you could encourage people to grow a couple of plants, if they're in an apartment, you know, on their balcony, if they're in the city, you know, somewhere, a couple of plants that they could then do something with, maybe it's food, maybe it's medicine, what would those be for you? I mean, and it's not, you know, I think everybody would have a different answer. There's probably not one, but I'm curious what your perspective would be in creating, how do you create that relationship, that connection?
The simple things like mints and calendula and lemon balm, you know, that are really easy to grow and make really good tea and things like that. And plants I love, though, like I love to have motherwort in my garden, and I wouldn't grow that in a pot, though, necessarily. You know, motherwort's kind of a big weed, but to me, I love the spirit of motherwort. So I think it's, and black cohosh I love to have in my garden, even though I don't harvest the root. But again, because I love the spirit of black cohosh, and I'm from West Virginia, and it reminds me of sort of that Appalachian forest. And so I think it's that too. It's like something that, yes, you can use, and also being open and curious to the plants that catch your attention, kind of like that taste, right? What catches your curiosity in that way, a kind of not a taste in your mouth, but a, you know, a taste in your attention, and invite them in some way. You know, black cohosh couldn't really grow in a pot either way, but you could grow in your garden.
Yeah. Now, mints are great too for that sort of that easy relationship. And, you know, it could be medicine for, you know, a kid's upset stomach, or it could be, you know, it could be just a nice cup of tea, or, you know, culinary. And that's, I am a big believer that if people cultivate something, even if it's small, just a pot of something, like the pride in that, the connection, like I did this, I nourished it, it came from here. I think that makes us all a little bit better. And I agree too, that the spirit of the plant might surprise you. Like a plant that I've connected with that is surprising to me is nettle. I love nettles, and I love wild nettles, cultivated nettles. You know, in Texas where I am, there's not, you don't find a whole lot of them, but the summer while we were in Colorado, I found a giant patch of wild nettle, and you know, just being able to pick them and, you know, and find the seeds, which are so rich and, you know, and nutritive. And, you know, the paradox of nettle, it's so prickly and it can give you a rash, but it's also so nourishing. And maybe there's a lesson in there.
So well, that's the other one I was going to say, nettles. Yeah. I love nettles and harvested.
Yeah.
And giving my kids nettle tea since they were tiny. Yeah.
Well, and anything else that you want to share before we wrap up, just about your work or what you would hope people would know around what sustainable looks like and what you hope to people take away from your work?
I don't know if this is from my work or something, but what I feel right now is now's the time. Like, so right now, this fall, I'm doing what feels quite scary in hosting this series of conversations with industry leaders using these practices from Theory U. And it feels, I'm trying to bring these tools that are not what are usually used and in these conversations, industry kinds of conversations, but I'm doing it because I feel like there's not time. Like we all have to do, we can't be scared anymore or hesitant or shy. Kind of what, again, what Gary Brown said, it's like things are bad out there, and what each of us, whatever gift we have to offer, what we see needs to be done. Don't think somebody else sees it, because we each see things in a particular way. And so see it and act on it, get the resources and support you need in whatever way that shows up. And the other thing I have found in working with plants, when I'm confused or lost, I ask them to sort of show up and point me in the next, not the whole path, but the next bit, like invite that in. And if I listen, that's another big theme in this book, is really listening beyond what I think I'm going to hear. And if I listen, then there's always a next step. So I guess those are the two things. Yeah, listen and go slow and act quickly.
Beautiful and powerful and harder than it sounds like sometimes. But thank you so much, Anne, for sharing with us. And I'm so glad that you were able to give this time and for your thoughtfulness and for your work that you've contributed to our planet and our people. And it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to have this time to sit and talk with you. I really appreciate it.